Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is about the best democracy money can buy. Matt Taibbi is interviewed by Tavis Smiley. The Rolling Stones editor explains the inner workings of Wall Street and criticizes the U.S. bank bailout. And after that, Timothy McBain talks to Andrew Bacevich about military-industrial complex cutbacks. Will the proposed defense cuts reduce the total national security budget?
Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone and best-selling author of books like The Great Derangement. His latest is called Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and The Long Con That Is Breaking America. Great title. He joins us tonight from San Francisco. Matt, good to have you on the program, sir.
Thanks for having me, Tavis.
Let me start with that quote of a couple of years ago, I guess a year or so ago now, that really was the impetus for the book. And the quote says, and I read, "The first thing you need to know about Goldman Sachs is that it's everywhere. The world's most powerful investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money." You said that a year ago, over a year ago now in Rolling Stone. It becomes, again, as I said, the impetus for the actual book. But I recall when that quote came out, it was, as you will recall, there was much commentary, conversation about that quote and whether or not journalists should be saying things, writing things so harsh. So take me back to the quote and what you recall about the controversy about it.
Well, the first thing that was really funny about that quote is that it almost actually didn't get into the magazine because the fact checkers called me up the night before we went to bed on that issue, and they were all a Twitter over the fact that squids don't have blood funnels. So we very nearly got into a factual problem, and I tried to explain to them that that was part of the joke. But we did that. This is very difficult material, this Wall Street stuff. It's very dense. It's boring to a lot of people. And yet we had to use some narrative techniques, some fiction writing techniques to try to get people excited in the material. And I kind of turned Goldman Sachs into a James Bond-style villain, and that helped focus people's attention, I think, on some of the issues. Now, I didn't have to make anything up in order to do that. I mean, as they say, this had the advantage of being true. But we did use some of those techniques. And some of that language, I thought it was a way to get people interested in material that otherwise they wouldn't have paid attention to.
Before I come back to the material, specifically the book, Griftopia, it occurs to me now that you work for a publication that over the last year or so has had a great deal to say about the very serious issues that many of us are wrestling with as Americans. I mean, this magazine, Rolling Stone, is given credit for bringing down a top-notch general, or a top general, I should say. Maybe the notch part is debatable. But certainly a top general was brought down by a piece in Rolling Stone. You've taken on Goldman Sachs and generated a lot of controversy around your reporting about the financial collapse. Talk to me about the power of magazines these days, like Rolling Stone, to have real stuff to say about real issues.
Well, I think we're kind of a dying breed in this profession. The print magazine and print journalism industry is obviously in a great deal of trouble. And one of the things that happened when this business started to give way to the internet and to broadcast television is that a lot of organizations started cutting specifically investigative journalism, and they also started cutting fact checkers. Those were two of the places they cut first. Mm-hmm. So there's very few places left in the journalism business where somebody like me has the luxury of spending 2 or 3 months, or Michael Hastings, who did the McChrystal piece, spending 2 or 3 months on a single story or traveling to Afghanistan and not producing something every single day. That's a tremendous rarity in our business nowadays. But I think it's still valuable. I think there still is a place for that. And as we've seen, it can still have an impact if we allow journalists mm-hmm. to do that kind of thing.
What is then, back to the book, Griftopia, and what is the griftocracy?
Well, what I'm really talking about in this book is a small group of politically connected banks that really have become too big to fail, and they've become intertwined with government to a point where they're completely immune from capitalist consequence. It's really interesting that we've had this great Tea Party movement that is all about restoring free market capitalist values, but what they've completely failed to understand is that what we've got now is a situation where there's a small class of gigantic financial companies that have put themselves above capitalism. They've now been able to rig the game so that they're going to win, or they're going to win no matter what happens, and no matter how stupid they act. And of course they did in the financial crisis act incredibly stupidly, and they not only didn't die out, they ended up ascendant and making more money than ever before.
Well, many of them did die out. A couple of them were let go, number one.
That's true, a few, yeah.
A few were let go, and these others, I understand the point you're making, I just want to push it a little bit. A few did die out. Lehman comes to mind immediately, of course.
Bear, yeah.
Exactly. But there are others, though, who only survive, which you talk about in the book, because we, the American taxpayer, bailed them out. So they're not necessarily. So explain to me more what you mean when you say above capitalist consequence, since we had to bail them out of the mess they got themselves into.
But we shouldn't have bailed them out. I mean, that's the whole point. You know, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Citigroup, a lot of these companies would not have survived in September of 2008 had these companies not been able to call up their former co-workers in government. You know, the great example being Goldman Sachs, which, you know, was able to have call up Hank Paulson, the former head of Goldman Sachs, and not only have him green light the AIG bailout, which resulted in $13 billion $1 billion that went straight to Goldman Sachs, but they also approved, for instance, the overnight transition of Goldman from an investment bank to a commercial bank. They got permission from the government to do that, which freed them up to borrow billions and billions of dollars from the Federal Reserve at 0% interest. I think without the ability to reach out to the government at a time of need and get enormous amounts of bailout money and all these special favors, a lot of these companies would have fallen flat in their face or gone bankrupt, and they didn't do that.
Juxtapose for me, Matt, your terminology of government as a slavish lapdog to these financial institutions versus the Obama administration and Democrats in Congress telling us that what they gave us a few months ago was financial reform that had teeth in it.
Well, they're going to say that, but most of the people that I talk to in Wall Street, they'll all tell you that what was passed, the Dodd-Frank bill, while it had some good things in it, most notably the ban on proprietary trading, the so-called Volcker rule, really there wasn't anything done to change the essential problems that led to the financial crisis. The biggest problems, again, being that these banks are simply too big now. The main problem is that we cannot let these banks fail, no matter how irresponsible we are. And there were efforts early on in the Dodd-Frank process to try to break up some of these companies and make them smaller, but we failed to do that, and that's an important problem that we didn't address.
Is it just the banks, or is this broader than the banks? And I raise that because, as I've said many times on this program while this was going on, the healthcare debate, that is, the stock of the healthcare industry went through the roof the week it was announced that they had cut this deal with the Obama administration. So clearly they were happy. If there was going to be healthcare reform, they were happy with what they got, again, to the point that their stock went up. So is it just the financial industry that has government by the throat, or does it move beyond that?
No, and actually, I included a whole chapter in this book about the healthcare reform, specifically to point that out, that, in fact, the insurance industry, you know, they were able to survive this entire healthcare reform effort without having anybody touch their antitrust exemption. I mean, not many people know that insurance companies are legally allowed to collude and set prices. You know, all the things that movie The Informant with Matt Damon in it, which sort of villainized a group of agricultural companies for getting together and setting the prices of a certain kind of corn product. People don't realize that that's legal in the health insurance industry. And that antitrust exemption was preserved throughout this entire process because just as you say, the insurance companies were able to meet with the Obama administration and cut backroom deals and create and craft something they called healthcare reform that didn't touch the essential subsidy of their industry.
So what happens now to the griftocracy now that Republicans will be running things in the House, now that the Tea Party has made a statement, whatever that might have been, just days ago on election? What happens to the griftocracy now?
Well, clearly, there hasn't been a whole lot of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans with regard to the policy towards Wall Street. If anything, the Democrats have really been worse over the last 15 years or so. The two major deregulatory actions that led to the financial crisis, which were the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1998 and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act in 2000, which deregulated derivatives, those were both done under Bill Clinton's watch. But the Republicans are very much anxious to do the bidding of Wall Street. And in fact, the day after the elections last week, one of the first things they announced was their intention to try to roll back the Volcker rule, that very thing I just mentioned.
Yeah.
The one thing in the Dodd-Frank rule that Wall Street guys tell me was a good idea, this ban on proprietary trading, this risky gambling for the bank's own accounts. That was the first thing that they decided to do, was to try to roll back the Volcker rule. And that tells you a lot about where their priorities are. I think a lot of ordinary Tea Parties don't realize that, you know, they elected these guys with a mandate to end bailouts and end subsidies of Wall Street. But the reality was that one of the first things they did was try to reach out and do a favor for Wall Street.
I got just 30 seconds here left. Matt, you save, to my read at least, you save some of your harshest criticism or critique for Alan Greenspan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I was trying to do there was show this sort of mentality, this incredible contradiction in Greenspan's personality, because on the one hand, he symbolized this ideology that is very popular now, this sort of notion that government has no place in business, there should be no regulation whatsoever. He very publicly advocated that kind of ideology, but at the same time, he was building this gigantic welfare state for Wall Street by continually bailing these guys out with lower interest rates and cheap Federal Reserve money every time they blew themselves up in a speculative crisis. So there's this incredible contradiction between no regulation on the one hand, no government, and total government welfare state on the other hand, and that's really where we are right now.
It's a great deconstruction of what happened when this crisis hit. It's written by Matt Taibbi. The book is called Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and the Long Con That is Breaking America. I just love saying it. Matt, good to have you on the program, and all the best to you.
Thanks for having me on.
To learn more, visit pbs.org/Tavis Smiley.
That was Matt Taibbi, interviewed by Tavis Smiley. And next, Timothy McBain talks to Andrew Basevich about the military-industrial complex cutbacks.
On what planet is a 4% spending increase a huge cut?
From TomDispatch.com, this is TomCast. Interviews and insight from Tom Dispatch contributors for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of our post-9/11 world and a clear sense of how our global imperial system actually works. I'm Timothy McBain. This week, I had the pleasure of speaking again with retired U.S. Army Colonel Andrew Basevich, who is currently a professor of history and international relations at Boston University and author most recently of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew and I talked about proposed cuts in the defense budget and whether they are, in fact, cuts at all. There has been quite a bit of media coverage regarding cutbacks in defense spending, and in fact, the Washington Post just published an article last Friday using the same metaphor you use in your article, but making the opposite argument. They said that the cuts illustrate that the defense budget is no longer a sacred cow. What do you make of these reports?
I think actually it continues to be a sacred cow. I know there's a lot of chit-chat about defense cuts. My expectation is that if there are any cuts, they will be cuts in the rate of growth of the defense budget. But to expect any substantial reductions in overall spending, I think that's unrealistic. Matter of fact, there was another article in the Post, I think it was today. They had surveyed Republican members of Congress in both houses and asked members whether or not they would support any real reductions in defense spending. And if I'm remembering correctly, it was no more than 15% of Republicans would agree to real reductions, with a great majority in favor of either the status quo or of spending more. So I personally don't think that we're going to see much on that front.
I think it's easy for people to be unsure of the true extent of U.S. military spending when they hear conflicting numbers and differing categories such as defense spending, military spending, the Pentagon budget. And of course, budgets don't necessarily reflect actual spending. Can you help clarify how much is being spent, what the money is being spent on, and who is doing the spending?
Probably we should use a term like national security budget. If we use that term, it would encompass the spending of the Defense Department, of the Department of Homeland Security, of the nuclear weapons aspects of the Department of Energy, and of the intelligence community. I honestly don't know what that number would be. I'm guessing it's probably somewhere in the vicinity of about $900 billion a year. That number would include both expenditures to maintain the national security establishment, along with an additional sum of money that is being expended to prosecute military operations, primarily in Afghanistan and in Iraq. I believe that the expenditures in Afghanistan for the current fiscal year are estimated at something like $130 billion a year. Certainly, money already expended in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11 exceeds $1 trillion. And of course, there are estimates, serious estimates, by Professor Stiglitz and his collaborator, Linda Blimes, that project that the total costs of the Afghanistan and Iraq war, before all things are done, before the last veteran gets his last veteran's payment the day before he dies, probably going to be upwards of $3 trillion.
In the 50 years since Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex, what has been the nature of national security spending? Is it qualitatively different now than it was 10 or 20 or 50 years ago?
It's different in the sense that as a percentage of overall federal spending, the number's gone down. As a percentage of GDP, it's gone down. In Eisenhower's day, we were spending probably 10% of GDP on this national security budget. Today, it's probably around 5 or 6%. And indeed, militarists cite that relative decrease by way of arguing that there's nothing extraordinary and nothing out of the ordinary in the way we're spending money today. That said, another way of looking at it is that we are spending more today in constant dollars on national security than at any time during the Cold War. And of course, during the Cold War, the justification for high levels of spending to justify high levels of spending, we pointed to the Soviet threat, the Soviet Empire, communism. today that threat has gone. The threats that presumably we are concerned about are relatively small compared to the Soviet Empire, and yet we're spending more now than we were then. One of the paradoxes that really deserves attention. And then the second sort of comparative number, which I think is even more staggering, is that we're spending as much on national security as the rest of the planet put together. That's been the case pretty much since the end of the Cold War, and it's really historically unprecedented.
Another paradox that I keep seeing in the reports on these proposed cutbacks is they keep saying cuts, 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 but the budget will continue to increase. How can they be cutting and getting more money?
Well, my sense of what Secretary Gates is engaged in is the following. He does recognize that there's a tremendous amount of waste, programs that are ill-advised or ill-managed, and he recognizes that evidence of waste provides ammunition to critics of this bloated budget. In order to take that ammunition away, he is trying to target specific programs that provide that ammunition. His political purpose is to project an image of the Department of Defense as a well-managed enterprise. I think that his policy purpose is to then shift the money, not give money back to the Treasury, but to shift the money from these ill-advised, ill-managed programs into other programs that he believes are more important. So he's engaged in a process of reallocation.
If these what are being called cuts are actually reallocation, is there anybody proposing an actual reduction in the percentage of the U.S. government's budget that goes towards military spending? And is there even a chance something like that would be implemented?
Well, I think there are a handful of members of Congress who would support real reductions, but they don't possess the clout. They do not constitute anything like a majority. President Obama himself, his administration, I think, would view serious reductions in defense spending as politically ill-advised. So I don't think this is an idea that's going to go very far.
Well, it seems to me that on the surface, at least, then Gates's proposals are fairly in line with what a lot of Americans would like to see the government do. That is, not increase spending, just use what you have more efficiently, kind of cut waste, invest in what works. Is that something we can look forward to seeing happen, or is this kind of just a political maneuver?
Well, it is a political maneuver, but I think Secretary Gates is a pretty shrewd operator, and my guess is that his effort is likely to succeed in dampening whatever urge there is to cut spending. So he'll be able to say, look, we are taking prudent steps in order to ensure that the taxpayers' dollar is being well spent, and my guess is that, by and large, that will quell whatever unhappiness with the level of defense spending exists. Again, emphasizing that I don't think that unhappiness rises to the level of posing any real threat to the defense budget. The problem with Secretary Gates's approach, from my point of view, is that it really avoids taking on any of the larger issues. I mean, I think this is an important question that Americans ought to ask as they reflect on almost a decade of extraordinary military exertions. The question is, what have we gotten for our money? I think the answer is precious little. And if that's the case, then shouldn't some of the assumptions or expectations that have informed policy over the last decade receive serious scrutiny? But none of that really gets any attention.
Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
You can read Andrew Bacevich's article, Cow Most Sacred, Why Military Spending Remains Untouchable, at tomdispatch.com. There you will also find a link to more information on Andrew's latest book, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. I'm Timothy McBain, and until we meet again, thanks for listening.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.